a bit more meat on the promise I had yesterday, to give you an analogy about the analogy between Feynman diagrams in quantum field theory and the perturbative processing in string theory. So let me draw again roughly some Feynman diagram and some roughly equivalent string diagram. So I would like to make the analogy between this picture and this picture precise. So in order to do that, it will be useful to recast the Feynman diagram in a somewhat evocative way. So let's say that we're talking about the Feynman diagram of some scalar field theory. Okay, so all of these lines are scalar fields, scalar particle labeled by some momentum. Let me call this graph gamma. And later I'm going to call this surface sigma. So to write down a Feynman amplitude, we need to assign momenta to the lines of this diagram, put propagators, momentum conservations, and so on. Let me just give some label to the external legs and to the vertices. Okay. So we need to put some momentum on each line, say momentum P17 going from 1 to 7, or I could call it also minus P71, P76 to minus P67, etc. And using these notations, the Feynman diagram roughly will look like this. Okay, I guess that's gone there. I get used to it. Sorry, I typically do it in Alice. Okay. Whatever. So my objective is to write an expression that roughly looks like this. So I want to recast the Feynman diagram amplitude as a sort of one-dimensional but integral, an integral of all possible ways to draw my diagrams in space-time, with some action which will depend on some intrinsic data, of intrinsic geometry of the diagram, something like proper lengths or intermediate lines, and then an integral over this intrinsic geometry. The reason I want to do that is because later on I will write a similar expression for the string amplitudes. So the string theory amplitudes will be given as an integral of all possible ways to map the surface sigma into space-time with some intrinsic geometry, and then an integral over geometry of the surface. So in order to motivate this expression and understand how this come about, I would like to first demonstrate how the same expression holds in quantum field theory. So let's start from the more conventional expression for a perturbative amplitude. Now, I hope that this is visible to everybody, even the one sitting in the back. Okay. Okay, so you see, I take a propagator for each internal leg with some momentum. I'm going to integrate over the momenta that run to internal legs. And I need to make sure that the momentum is conserved at every vertex. Okay, pretty elementary. Now, I can do two manipulations on this expression. I can take my propagators and write them in a sort of proper time form. And I can take the momentum conservations and rewrite them in Fourier transform. Okay. I hope this both these manipulations are okay. Notice I'm not taking care of factors of pi to pi I or anything like that. This is a common theme of these lectures. Okay, so let's plug this expression in here. After we plug them in, the momentum integrals become Gaussian, so I can just do them. And I get an alternative expression. So A again are internal vertices. I'm not going to write it again. Okay, let's look at this for a while. So what happened? My original integral over momenta has been replaced by an integral over positions of the interaction vertices. And over these extra parameters for each word line, which will soon recognize as being essentially the proper length of that line. And then some kind of expression which you might remember from quantum mechanics. So this expression gives the amplitude for a particle to move from xA to xB in a proper time, LAB. So let's make this statement explicit. I want to get this out of some nice quantum mechanics path integral describing the motion of a particle in space. So let me start with the action of a particle. So the action, classically, the action of a relativistic free particle is just proportional to its length, to the length of its trajectory, which, if you remember some geometry, can be written in this form. So you pick some parametrization of your trajectory with some parameter u, and this gives you the length of the trajectory. Now, the choice of parameter u is completely arbitrary. I just had some curve in space-time. I needed to parameterize it some way. And I use some parameter u. I could have used another parameter. This action has a parametrization invariance. Or you can just change your coordinate along the path. This is not a physical choice. It's a gauge choice. So ultimately, when we do a path integral, we want to integrate over the trajectories, not the trajectories with the choice of parametrization, because otherwise we'll vastly overcount. Now, this is not a great action because it's not polynomial. So actually, I don't we don't know how to actually quantize. I mean, I can write down a formal expression. But I don't know what it means. So to improve the situation, we would like to make this action quadratic, or at least polynomial. A first step in the direction is to introduce an auxiliary variable. So I'll define a new action. So this action has the property that if I integrate away e, I recover this. But now it's polynomial, it's quadratic in x. So it's better. Of course, it's still not polynomial in e, so it's not clear that my situation has really improved at this stage. Notice now the parameterization invariant requires you to transform e. E transforms essentially as a one form. Or perhaps it's better to think about E squared as a metric. On the word line. This will be a useful analogy later on. Now, we added an auxiliary variable. We still have this gauge freedom. This auxiliary variable is bothering us because it's not entering polynomially. Well, let's get rid of it by gauge fixing. So the final step is to pick a gauge like e equal to 1. This fixes e completely, almost completely actually, because as you can see, the quantity integral from 0 to 1 of e to u is gauge invariant. So actually, I cannot quite pick e to 1. If I want my parameter to run from 0 to 1, I should really put e equal to 1 over L. Or I can just let my u run from 0 to L and pick e equal to 1. That's the same. Let's do that for simplicity. So my gauge fixed action now depends on x and on this proper length of the line. Call it LAB. And now it's nice and quadratic. Now, strictly speaking, we shouldn't completely forget about E. It's true that we have gauge fixed E, but the equations of motions of E are still there. So when you study this action, you should impose an extra constraint. Like in gauge theory, like the Gauss law in gauge theory, which essentially tells you that your particle is on shell. Okay, now I'm doing things a bit by hand with this gauge fixing. Later on, we'll learn how to do gauge fixing properly with BRST, BRST formalism, but for now, let me just forget about that. The main point that I'm trying to carry across is that we have transformed this integral, which was so and so well defined, into, let me just move this definition somewhere else. So we converted it first to an integral over the x, the e, over diffeomorphisms. And then we gauge fixed E. And we ended up with a standard integral over this zero mode, which is still there. We couldn't get rid of it with gauge fixing. And the path integral with his action. Okay. Now this is a quadratic path integral. It's the same one as you can find in quantum mechanics. And it's a nice exercise to verify that you go back here. So in principle, I could have taken this and said, okay, I'm going to rewrite it as the path integral of this sort. Okay, now we're essentially there. So look at this. Ignore for a moment the integral over or this length LABs. We have a graph, gamma, with vertices. We map the vertices somewhere in space-time, and we integrate over those positions. And then we take all possible ways to draw a line between those lines between those vertices and integrate over the shape of those lines. So this became that. I don't know if it's visible. Right? So I have a path integral over all possible ways to map my graph into space-time with some action, which depends on the length of the edges of the graph, and an integral over these lengths of edges. Okay? So I sort of have a moduli space of graphs with some intrinsic geometry, and I integrate over that. And the thing I'm integrating is a path integral. It's sort of the answer for a one-dimensional quantum field theory, in a sense, which lives on the graph. So this graph with some intrinsic geometry, I have some one-dimensional quantum field theory that lives on the graph, and which tells you how the graph is mapped into space-time. The fields of this quantum mechanics are the positions. So I do this one-dimensional path integral, I get the answer, plug it inside this fundamental integral, and that's my Feynman diagram amplitude. Okay, now I hope this will be a good preparation for this. Now let's try to repeat exactly the same manipulation, but for a theory of strings. So the main difference is that the string theory worksheet is two-dimensional instead of being a one-dimensional word line. Actually, before we do that, questions?
How do you integrate over the line after we do the path integral? Like I thought that like the order of integration has to be fixed.
Sure. Well, here it was already outside, right? All I did was to bring this integral outside of the integral of the position of the vertices. These are finite dimensional integrals. It's not a big problem. I mean, when I did this replacement, it was a bit up to me to decide the order of the integrals.
Before you erase it, when you wrote that question,
yes.
Like, was it a mistake? Like, because it seems like you shift the PAB already, but there's no reason to shift the PAB.
I don't think I shifted anything. So this quantity, right, was originally e to the minus xa minus xb squared over 4 lab squared minus m squared lab squared.
Yeah, but shouldn't that follow from here?
Yes, so this piece comes from here.
Yeah, and the other piece comes
now from we're integrating over momenta. Well, the momenta appear? They appear here,
okay.
And they appear here.
Mm-hmm.
Each momentum of internal leg appears exactly in two of these terms. One with xa and the other with xb.
Okay.
With opposite sign, because pab was equal to minus pba. Yes, I should have written it here. Class here. Anyway. Okay. So I need something like that starting point there. So how do I generalize that to a string? Well, a line was just that the action of a line was the length, the action of a string is the area. So let me call it S. S. Instead of mass, I have the tension. Okay, so I took the derivatives of x with respect to ua and ub, contracted them together. I got a matrix, a 2x2 matrix. U and a and ub, u1 and u2 are just coordinates on my string. I my my sheet, and I pick some local coordinates. As in the case of the particle, this choice is completely arbitrary. There is nothing physical about it. Notice that this action is invariant under changes of coordinates again. So if I take my UA and I replace them with some function, some other coordinates, this derivative is changed by the Jacobian. This matrix changes by the Jacobian acting on the two sides. The determinant changes by the Jacobian, by the determinant of the Jacobian squared. Take the square root, and the Jacobian cancels against the change of the measure. So this action is invariant under reparametrization. Now, again, it's not polynomial. This is called a Nambu-Goto action. It's not polynomial, so it's not something easy to quantize. But it can be made polynomial by exactly the same trick. Instead of adding a one-dimensional metric, we're going to add a two-dimensional metric as an auxiliary degree of freedom. So now I'm going to write some action that depends on x and h. I'll use the same notations that you might have seen in general relativity. So for example, the determinant of the metric would be indicated as h. H with upper indices is the inverse of the h with lower indices. And I think this is one of the exercises in your homework. To check that if you integrate away h, you recover this action. Now, this action is still invariant under reparametrization. But of course, now h has to transform as a metric. So h, a, b, dua, dub should be equal to h prime ab, du prime a, du prime b. Okay. And now it would be nice if we could continue the same way as for the particle. Just this action is not polynomial in the metric, but perhaps I can just gauge away the metric and be done. Except that different morphisms have 2 degrees of freedom, while the metric has 3 degrees of freedom. It's always possible if somebody gives you a metric to put it in the form to put it to a diagonal form. So you can know, at least locally, there is a theorem of differential geometry that you can always make your metric diagonal and multiple of the identity. But the what's called the conformal factor, the overall scale of the metric, cannot be eliminated by diffeomorphism. Which means that if we just use diffeomorphism invariance, we cannot get rid of the metric completely. Now, it just so happens that this classical action has an extra symmetry, a hidden symmetry, called Weyl symmetry. It's something special that happens only on two-dimensional worksheet, and essentially the reason for which we can do a theory of strings and not a theory of membranes. Weyl transformations just rescale the metric with a position-dependent factor. So you can see it was the Weyl symmetry here, because the metric the inverse metric transform with two to the minus alpha, and because this is a 2x2 matrix, the square root of the determinant transform with e to the alpha. So this is Weyl invariant. So that means that at least classically, we can pick some coordinate systems where the metric is multiple of the identity, and then because of Weyl invariance, phi will just drop out. So classically, I reduce myself immediately to a quadratic action. Quantum mechanically, things are not as easy. So what is the problem? The problem is that although the classical action is invariant under Weyl transformations, the same is not necessarily true of the measure of the path integral. It is not so difficult to understand. So the measure of the path integral requires some regularization in order to be defined. When you have a quantum field theory in space, in flat space, what do you do to regularize the measure? Typically, you expand your fields in Fourier modes, you throw away the modes that fluctuate on a scale that is shorter or some cutoff. Okay. Now, these X's are like quantum fields that live on this two-dimensional surface. Two-dimensional surfaces have a metric. So you might ask yourself, okay, how do I regularize the measure on a curved space-time? But again, if you have a metric, it's not that difficult. You can do it in a diffeomorphism invariant way, even. Just saying, okay, I say if I write down the Laplacian on my manifold or something like that, expand my fields in modes of this Laplacian, throw away all the modes that fluctuate, whose again value is bigger than some value, which means essentially all the modes that are fluctuating on a scale smaller than some cutoff, where I'm measuring the scale using the metric. If I measure the scale using the metric, this is diffeomorphism invariant, because the notion of distance is in diffeomorphism invariant. The problem is that if I use the definition and then I do a Weyl transformation, my definition of scale changes. My cutoff gets all messed up. I start with a nice position, roughly position-independent cutoff, and my cutoff suddenly becomes position-dependent. To go back to the original cutoff, I need to integrate in or out some degrees of freedom, and as a result, my measure changes. Now, a change in the measure under a symmetry transformation is not necessarily a tragedy. After all, there is a big degree of uncertainty on how to define the measure. We're just trying to define a measure. You give me some definition, I can say, okay, I can add some counter terms to it. I can modify it a bit and try to get another definition. Let's keep working until we find a definition which works, which has all the symmetries we want. So you sort of get a kind of a cohomological problem. You have a space of all possible things that go wrong, and inside there is a space of all things that can be corrected. But these spaces are complicated and infinite dimensional, because you can write all sorts of local functional of your fields to correct your measure. But the difference between the two turns out to be finite dimensional and not always zero. So for some symmetries, it can happen that the things that can go wrong, there are just more things that can go wrong than things you can fix. So the amount, so that this gives you sort of a finite set of numbers that tell you how wrong are the things that can go wrong. You know, it tells you if a certain measure, if a certain theory can have that symmetry or not, quantum mechanically. So in the case of wild symmetry in two dimensions for theories which have diffeomorphism invariants, there is just one number that tells you if things are going wrong. It's called the conformal anomaly or central charge. So there is just one number that tells you if some measure can be wild invariant or not. And it's not something you can compute. We will compute it during the next few lectures. For now, let me tell you the answer. So, you know, I really don't understand this. This is supposed to be moving the middle blackboard. And it's not moving the middle blackboard. Okay. Okay. Okay, so related to the calculation is that each scalar field you're integrating, each that the two-dimensional scalar field on a surface has anomaly one. Now we had a whole bunch of scalar fields all the way to the dimension of space-time. Because this fields X were telling us where is the string in space-time. And then there was an integral over the metric. And this is, contributes minus 26 to this number. So overall, if the dimension is 26, we have wild invariants. If the dimension is not 26, we don't have wild invariants. So a situation where you have wild invariants is called the critical string. Otherwise, it's called non-critical. Now, in the rest of the course, we're going to discuss critical strings. That's not just because because they behave better than non-critical strings. It's because secretly, non-critical strings can be reinterpreted as critical strings anyway. And I can perhaps sketch momentarily how that happens. So suppose that my dimension of space-time is not 26. So I actually do not have wild invariants in the measure. Well, that's fine. I'm still going to be able to take my metric and make it a multiple of the identity. The classical action will be independent of this conformal factor. The measure will not. So I can try to do a wild transformation to get rid of this conformal factor, but the measure will spit out something non-trivial. So what happens? So I will still have my instead of the integral on the metric, and I have the integral on this conformal factor. It's still going to be there because it didn't drop out. The classical action of the X fields does not depend on the conformal factor. But the transformation of the measure under Y transformation will give me something which depends on this conformal factor. Okay? So now when I look at this expression, I can say, well, this phi kind of looks like a new coordinate. This non-critical string really looks like a string which is moving in space-time and an extra direction. This extra direction is not quite the same as the other ones. This action here has all sort of stuff inside. It's not just a nice, simple quadratic action. But that's fine. So essentially, it's possible to recast a non-critical string as a critical string in some space-time which has some funny direction. Funny enough that it contributes precisely the correct anomaly to get you to 26.
Mm-hmm. Is the need to have Wieland readings come out just because we want to recast a square root action in terms of something which is polynomial?
Well, in a sense, the square root action was just not something I can put in a path integral. I don't know how to make sense of it. Once I get here, and then go to a diagonal gauge, things are starting to make sense. I have a quadratic action for the axis, plus an action for phi, which is quadratic plus some potential. So it's fine. So once I'm here, things are well defined. Except that I got something strange, which is I got a string which moves in a d plus one dimensional space-time with some funny behavior. It's fine. One can study that. Or I can stay in 26 dimensions, and then all my directions of space-time behave normally. And the conformal factor just drops out. So if I'm in critical strings, because Y symmetry is a true symmetry, I'm going to treat it as a gauge symmetry. So I'm going to define my path integral over the axis, over the metric, over the firm of prisms times Wieland. Okay?
So you can see this is like d plus one dimensional space in which the string moves, apparently.
Yes.
But if I just go back to the picture of the d-dimensional space,
mm-hmm.
is this just like a fluctuating string, like a fluctuating length, or how do I interpret this factor in the original?
It's an extra degree of freedom lives on the string on top of the ones that tell you what the string is. And because this degree of freedom also is a scalar field value in numbers, it's essentially telling you that the string is moving somewhere else. For example, I don't know, strings which have different values of this scalar field will just miss each other when they scatter. Yes?
Would you also have the gauge field related to the Wieland transformations living on the string?
That's the metric.
Okay.
Sorry, I'm not saying it properly. Having a gauge symmetry doesn't necessarily mean to having a gauge field. Having a gauge symmetry just means having a continuous symmetry of your fields, which identifies configurations which are physically equivalent.
Yeah, what if it's a local symmetry? So you have e to the alpha of u.
Yes.
Then if you write on any kinetic term for h, then you would have to have a covariant derivative on that guy, right? And then you would have to meet again.
That's true, but I didn't.
Okay, but
that's my action.
Okay.
So H has no kinetic term in this action.
Yeah.
Notice that it's pretty hard to make a kinetic term in two dimensions out of the metric. You could say, okay, I'll take my Einstein action, except that the integral of the curvature on the surface is 2 pi, or something like that. So this is pretty much the most general thing you could do.
For a non-critical string, how can you decompose the action into two parts? Like
I didn't. So this was the original action.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Sorry, I skipped a step. So let's do it more carefully. Right, we start with the measure. The measure depends on the choice of metric. Okay, so let me say that I went to the diagonal gauge. Okay. Then I have my integral over the Hoffman factor, and I have my action e to the s of x. There was a metric here too, but the metric dependence is such that it drops out if the metric has this form. Okay? Now I do a wild transformation. This doesn't change. This doesn't change. What I'm doing is I'm regularizing my measure for the axis using the standard flat metric instead of this metric. So I'm going to say that this is equal the x with the flat metric. Okay. But I need to pay a price. The price is what I'm calling e to the s of phi. I could write it down. I just didn't write it in my notes, so I will surely make mistakes. But you can find it in the Polchinski. It's pretty much a quadratic action, something like the phi squared plus e to the phi. So there is an e to the phi potential. And then there is a funny coupling to the curvature of the worksheet, something like phi times the Ricci curvature. Well, I mean, that really drops out once you go to flat metric. So it would take a little bit more time than I have to discuss it properly. It's something that is called the linear dilaton background. Okay, anyway, so I'm here. Now I gauge fix. And I'm going to essentially define this as an integral over all possible choices of metric modulo diffeomorphisms, modulo dual transformations. And then the path integral over the axis with the quadratic action. So let me say a few more words. So all I said about the fact that the metric can be made diagonal, can be made multiple of the identity, is a local statement. So if I take my worksheet, it's probably time to get one more blackboard here. Or even that one, why not? Okay, let me take my surface sigma, which describes the motion of the string in space-time. Initially, this had some metric on it and some fields that describe the position of space-time. Now, locally on some patch, I can find a coordinate system where the metric is multiple of the identity. And then this drops out. Then I can find another patch and do the same. I can do it in another patch, in another patch. Now, these patches are compatible in the sense that the coordinate transformation from this patch to this patch must be such that it sends a metric of this form to a metric of this form. But there is no way to glue these patches together to just make a big patch. So there is an obstruction, topological obstruction, to just putting the metric to just finding a coordinate system globally on the whole surface in which the metric is conformally flat. Okay. After all, this surface definitely is not a blackboard. It's not flat. It's not a flat sheet of paper. So I shouldn't be able to put a flat metric everywhere. Okay. So in general, if you give me a picture like this, some sigma, there would be a moduli space of possible ways to cover it with patches of this form. Again, it's a finite dimensional moduli space. But it's still, it's some part of the metric, some piece of the metric, which you couldn't gauge away. So it's analogous to those lengths. Those lengths are quantities you couldn't gauge away with the diffeomorphism. On a surface, there are similarly some quantities which you cannot get rid of. They're just a little bit more difficult to define. And I'm going to discuss them today and probably later on in the next few lectures. But the point is, this integral, once you use diffeomorphism and wild to eat up as much of the metric as you can, reduces to this finite dimensional integral over some reference matrix, and then path integral of some free fields coupling to this geometry. So I have a path integral over all possible ways to map my surface to space-time, and then integrals over all possible intrinsic geometries of the surface.
Is dUi represent the surface area, the sigma?
No. So, for example, the surface area is not one invariant quantity. It's actually pretty tricky to figure out how do I get something, some information out of the metric which is invariant under diffeomorphisms and under wild transformations. It's not quite easy. But intuitively, you kind of want to do ratios of distances, ratios of areas, ratios of lengths, things that can be invariant under wild transformations. But I'm going to give you an example momentarily. I just wanted to make sure that it's clear why are we going to present string theory in this form. Now notice that now this is completely computable. So we went from something essentially uncomputable or ill-defined, which was this Namugoto finitely with a Namugoto action, to something which is relatively easy at the end because it's a free path integral with some quadratic action on some non-trivial geometry, followed by a finite dimensional integral. Doesn't get any easier than that. Okay?
How is this moduli space encoded in the original action? Like, where does it come from in there? How is this, like, all this topological information on, like, this?
So, it labels the possible orbits of diffeomorphism times wild inside the space of matrix.
But in the original, I think, Namugoto action, the square.
Oh, it was not there at all.
Yeah.
The original action, there was no metric.
Yeah.
In the same way as for the quantum field theory, right, in the original form of the Feynman diagram, there were no intrinsic lengths of the edges. But introducing them allows you a neat, intuitive picture of what the Feynman diagram does. Here, introducing them allows you to do calculations. A bit more serious. But sorry, so there could be other ways to do string theory. There are alternative formulations of string theory. The problem is that usually you get stuck with the problem that you cannot do, you don't know how to do calculations just because you get some two-dimensional quantum field theory in the worksheet, which is not free. Okay. So let me discuss briefly how does this moduli space look like. So So in order to understand this question, it turns out to be very useful to introduce complex coordinates. Okay? So once you are in a flat once you have a flat matrix, you can pick, you can define coordinates which are something like u1 plus I u2. And then write this simply as dz, dz bar. Now, suppose I take these coordinates and I do a change of coordinates which is holomorphic. So suppose I try to define z as an holomorphic function of some other coordinate, some other complex coordinate. Then what happens to this? This transforms in a very nice way. So in particular, you went from a metric which was flat to a metric which is conformally flat. So this is something you can eliminate with a Weyl transformation. Now, what's non-trivial, it's again a theorem of differential geometry, is that this is also, that the converse is also true. That when you have this sort of atlas on your surface of coordinates which are related by, which in which the metric is a multiple of the identity, you can always go and find an atlas where your patches are holomorphic coordinate patches. And your coordinate transformations are of this form. So essentially, the problem of finding orbits of metrics under Weyl transformation diffeomorphisms is reduced to the problem of finding holomorphic coordinate patches on your manifold. This is called the complex structure. The complex structure on a manifold is essentially a choice of complex coordinates in patches such that when you go from a patch to the other, the coordinate transformations are holomorphic. So this space is the space of complex structures on sigma. Okay. Now, this space only depends on the genus of the surface, essentially the number of handles the surface has. So perhaps I can give, I have time to give an example of a non-trivial moduli space. So suppose I want to study a process at one loop with no external legs coming in. It's something that in quantum field theory you could try to use to compute the normalization of your partition function. I mean, usually it's something you throw away, but it's just an instructive example. So suppose my surface looks like a torus, like a surface of a donut. How can I put a complex structure on this? And how many complex structures can I put? Well, if you cut it and unwrap it, sigma actually looks like this. Now, suppose I'm going to cut it along this to make a cylinder, and then I'm going to cut it along a line that goes the long way. If you can, you should be able to visualize that it becomes essentially a rectangle, okay, with opposite side identified. It's a rectangle, is flat, okay, so suppose I want my mesh, you know, it's a patch of the complex plane. Well, I can sort of decide what is the shape of this patch. I could say, okay, I'm cutting this this gives me a torus. Or you could say, no, I want to cut this. This gives me a torus. Now, are they the same torus or not? I mean, do they have the same complex structure or not? Well, intuitively, not, because if I try to map this into here, I need to change my angles. I could say keep the same x coordinate, but I need to change my y coordinate to rotate it up. But if I keep the same x coordinate and I change my y coordinate, my holomorphic coordinate is changing in a bad way. I'm mixing the real imaginary parts. I mean, you can write the transformation, you're going to get something that mixes z and z bar. Now, a more intrinsic way to think about this is that this surface is a very nice one form, the z. Okay?
What is dz?
Dz is a one form. Do you guys see differential forms?
Yes.
Okay. So I'm going to do dz.
Yeah, but a surface would be a two form, not a one form. Maybe.
No, I'm saying this had, there is, I can define a one form on this, okay. Dz. It's well defined, it's not zero, it's not infinity anywhere on this nice rectangle. And because I'm making the torus by gluing things under a translation, and translations don't change this, this is well defined everywhere. I mean, I can really draw it, okay? Some constant vector field of my torus. And now I can do things like integral of the z along some contour. If I integrate it, say, suppose that this side was 1 and this side was tau. Okay. So if I integrate it along a contour that goes like this, I get 1. If I integrate it along a contour that goes like that around the torus, I get tau. And so the ratio between these two things is an invariant. So, sorry, I'm going a bit too fast because time is short, but what I'm trying to say is that take a general complex surface in this shape, with this topology of the torus. It's possible to prove that you can always find a one form that has no poles, that is well defined everywhere. And this one form is unique up to rescaling. That means is that if you integrate this one form on some cycle of the torus, or integrate on some other cycle of the torus and take the ratio, this is an invariant quantity. It's defined without choice of coordinates. It just labels your complex structure. It's analogous to those lengths. So in quantum field theory, instead of a torus, you would have just a line. You would say, okay, the length of this line is a gauge invariant quantity. I'm saying that in this kind of indirect way, by looking at forms on the surface and their periods, you can, and the ratios of these periods, you can define invariant quantities which are independent, you know, that are sort of labeled different complex structures of the surface. Now, of course, you could have taken other choices of cycles. You could have taken something that wraps around the torus a certain number of times one way and a certain number of times the other way. So this ratio here, this tau, instead of tau, I could have found something else if I had picked a different choice of cycles. But what I find is always to the form A tau plus B over C tau plus D, where A, B, C, and D are integers. Okay, so I'll go over these things again. I just wanted to sort of introduce them. But the moduli space of complex structures on a torus is parameterized by a choice of tau of a complex number modulo these transformations. And you can draw some pretty pictures and find the moduli space over which you need to integrate. And so on and so forth. So we will spend some time over the next few lectures to learn how to understand these moduli spaces. Although typically we'll just focus on three amplitudes. So that's going to be a bit easier than this example. OK. Yeah, perhaps I can say just one more thing very quickly. So as I'm saying, here there is just one moduli space given a topology of the surface. And the topology is just essentially how many handles does it have. This means that there are, in a sense, much fewer. There is just one space here in situations where there will be a whole lot of spaces over there. So suppose that you have something that looks. Suppose you have a process where you have two particles coming in and two particles coming out at three levels. In quantum field theory, you would do this. Or you could do these, or you could do these. Okay. So each of these will give you a moduli space, which is essentially a half line. Because this length can be arbitrarily long, but it has to be positive. And you know, intuitively, you could say these moduli spaces are meeting together at this point. So if I were to draw the moduli space of quantum field theory, I would say, OK, I have a half line, another half line, another half line. I do a calculation here, a calculation here, a calculation here, and add them together. If you look at the same picture in string theory, this can look like this, or like this, or like this, depending on how you're looking at it. There is just one surface that contributes to all these processes. And you get a moduli space, which roughly looks like this. Sort of you fatten up these lines into tubes, not to be confused with the strings. But as the moduli space of string theory has typically one extra dimension, one extra compact direction compared to the quantum field theory one. And then the moduli space has many corners which look like individual quantum field theory processes. OK. Is called channel duality. I will see it very explicitly. We'll compute exactly at the end of the, well, towards the end of the second week, we'll compute this, and we'll see that it has pieces look like this, or like this, or like this.